Okay. Well, welcome everyone to the LDS PPA Roundtable. We're really glad that you can join us. I'm going to make one announcement before we get started. If you helped on a project that was published in 2016, you should submit it to our Praiseworthy Awards program to get a cash prize. So the categories, so this is our LDS PPA specific, or this is our LDS PPA Awards program, but you don't have to be a member of LDS PPA to submit. Actually, I'll get to that in a sec. The categories for the program, for the awards program that you can submit for are text publications, multimedia, and audio-video publications. And each of those three categories, you can submit short or long form. So there's six total categories. And awards are granted to not just the author and main producer of the publication, but to the entire team. So if you worked on a project as an author or an editor or designer, illustrator, director, whatever your role was, you can submit this your publication for consideration for the award. And the award, the cash prize will be awarded to the team. And you get a plaque and some bragging rights and all that good stuff that comes with winning awards. Only one person on the team needs to be LDS. But no one on the team has to be a member of LDS PPA, so that opens it up quite a bit. And if you want more details about the awards program, you can go to ldspta.org/awards. And the deadline for that is April 30th, so that'll be coming up. All right. That's all I have for announcements. By the way, I forgot to introduce myself. I'm Caroline Larson. I'm the operations manager of LDS PPA. So if you've ever messaged or emailed, there's a chance that you've talked to me. Just kind of help behind the scenes, helping things flow. Our director of education, Susie Bills, wasn't able to make it today, so I'm kind of helping, facilitate and introduce our speaker today. Our speaker today is novelist Dave Butler, who will speak to us on the hero's journey as a guide to editing fiction. Dave worked as a securities lawyer for major international companies before going solo. So he now works as a law consultant and a corporate trainer. Dave has been writing speculative fiction since 2010. Some of his books include The Kidnap Plot, Witchy Eye, and City of Saints. And he also works as an acquisitions editor for Woodfire Press. So it sounds like he's a pretty busy guy. Dave also performs in a semi-improvised interactive theater at sci-fi and fantasy conventions in a group called the Space Balrogs, which is an awesome name. I approve. And his wife, Emily, is also a novelist, and they have three children. So, Dave, thanks so much for speaking to us today, and take it away.
Thank you, Caroline. I know we have some writers and we have some editors, and I don't have a sense of everybody's experience. So I think the easiest thing for me to do is assume little experience or exposure. But if I am talking to too simple a point, I'm going to rely on you to tell me. Please feel free to jump in at any point. And I think this is going to be a facilitated conversation rather than me just talking. So fiction has structure, right? Fiction has structure. Let me give you my favorite extremely basic example. 12-bar blues song. 12-bar blues, as it might be sung by Robert Johnson or Charlie Patton in the 1930s, every verse follows, or almost always, every verse follows the same structure, which goes like this. You have one line, okay? So Robert Johnson's song, Love in Vain, the first verse, the first line goes, I followed her to the station, suitcase in my hand. Then you have a second line, and it is exactly the same, or possibly it has one or two words different. I followed her to the station, suitcase in my hand. And then you have a third line, it's hard to tell, when all your love's in vain. So you can go find, and there are 10,000 songs out there recorded following exactly the same verse pattern. Why do we write fiction with structure? What's the value of having structure in a fictional piece?
Gives you somewhere to hang your hat.
Yeah, if you're the writer, one of the things it does is it helps you figure out where to go. So my experience as a writer is that usually I get one, and I like this metaphor from a medieval Islamic Persian story called The Conference of the Birds. I think the author is Farid Uddin Attar. I could be wrong about that. The Conference of the Birds, and it starts with the birds are having a conference, and a feather that they cannot identify falls from heaven. That's how I feel like stories start. You get a feather from heaven, and it's a single idea, and maybe it's an interesting character. Maybe it is a scene. Oh, wouldn't it be cool if there was a whatever, right? If there was a fight scene on the Statue of Liberty, and then you eventually write Remo Williams. After that, it's mostly work. And there are moments of additional kind of inspiration from the muses along the way, but mostly it's work. And I think most of the work, one of the most powerful tools in that work is to understand the structure of what you're writing, because you know what readers expect, right? You can ask yourself conscious questions. I have a character. Well, what's an interesting conflict involving this character? What does this character want? What is going to have to happen to this character next? So I think as a writer, it gives you something to hang your head on. It gives you a tool for creating your song, your poem, your story. So then as an editor, what's the value of knowing or recognizing structure in the piece you're looking at?
I think it helps the editor kind of as an advocate for the reader, kind of helping organize the structure in a way that the reader can follow, I guess.
I love that. I love the idea of being an advocate for a reader, right? I mean, one thing an editor might do is, you know, strengthen prose, correct punctuation, clarify ideas. But also, yeah, the editor is the early reader. And the editor is having the reader experience first and wants to help the author strengthen what the author is doing so she can communicate more clearly to the reader, so she can share the tale more clearly, so she can reach the moment of catharsis more clearly. So I think that's right. I think knowing maybe it's in a nonfiction context, right? Being familiar with a three-paragraph essay format. Pretty useful for helping for editing somebody's three-paragraph essay, right? Similarly, I think that being familiar with structure in fiction helps us diagnose when something could be improved. It helps us make more focused, more powerful suggestions to an author. So I actually want to spend a few minutes talking about a different structure before we jump to the hero's journey. The hero's journey is can be a little recondite. You may have heard of it, and maybe not. But I want to tell you about another example of structure in fiction that whether you've realized it or not, you've seen it 1,000 times. As an example for what I'm talking about, and that is the Hollywood three-act structure. So every Hollywood movie that you have, well, not every, almost every Hollywood movie you ever saw, 99% of them, follow a virtually identical structure. And that's been true for a long, long time. And that is a three-act structure. By the way, the Elizabethan playwrights used a five-act structure. Okay, but Hollywood uses a three-act structure, and here's how it goes. Act one is approximately 25 to 30 minutes long. And we need to do a few things in Act One. We need to meet our protagonist. We need to see what her world, her daily world is like. We need to see, ideally, what she wants most. What does she desire? What does this protagonist want to do? What's her dream? What's her ambition? What's she trying to accomplish? And why can't she do it? And then Hollywood's Act One ends in a moment of crisis. There's some event that happens, and you can watch with a clock, watch a Hollywood film, and sometime around minute 25, and no later than minute 30, something there'll be a car wreck, or there will be a letter, from an anonymous letter with a dramatic piece of news, or I just heard that my grandmother died, or something. Something will happen that is a big opportunity, or more likely is a sort of a disaster, presents a problem for the main character. So in fact, if you think about this, let's think about this in terms of Star Wars. And when I say Star Wars, I mean the only true Star Wars, Episode 4, A New Hope. So we meet Luke, right? Luke's our protagonist. What does Luke want?
To get off Tatooine.
He wants it. Man, he's the small kid stuck in Kansas. No offense if you're from Kansas. He's a small kid stuck in Provo, Utah, where I live, right? The small town kid. He wants to get out. He wants to go, and his friend Biggs, right? Biggs Darklighter is going to the academy. He's going to be an Imperial pilot. And he and Biggs have been shooting womp rats out in the canyons and Tatooine, and he's as good as Biggs is. Why can't he leave off the farm? He's got to stick around with Aunt Beru and Uncle Owen, right? And we see all this, and he even has an opportunity to leave. Obi-Wan kind of invites him. We'll come back to that in a bit. And he doesn't. You know, so we see that he's reluctant about it, but he's dutiful and, you know, good kid. And then what happens about half an hour, 25 minutes, half an hour in, that is a disaster that sets Luke off on his adventure? It involves stormtroopers.
Well, they come kill
his family. Yeah, that's exactly right. Right, he comes back to the farm, and Aunt Beru and Uncle Owen are dead. So that's the end of Act One from a Hollywood point of view. Now, a Hollywood film then has an Act Two, and this is the long act. This is the long act, and. Usually you'll have a moment about halfway in where things get really uncomfortable. They get more sort of the tension rises. And then at the end, so this act is usually something like 45 minutes to an hour long. It's sort of the meat of the film. And then the act two ends at a low moment. It ends at apparent defeat. It ends, they think they have been, hero thinks she or he has lost, right? In romantic comedy, they break up. And you always have the scenes where you see them walking apart and they're seeing the places they used to visit together, but now they're sad and lonely, right? So act two ends in a low moment. And Act Two in Episode Four in Star Wars ends at a moment of fear, a moment of great fear, because they've escaped the Death Star. They, Luke, and his party, but they've had a great loss. Right, Obi-Wan has died. Luke's sort of guide to the Force has died, and moreover, the Death Star is going to come kill them. Right, it ends at a very low moment, and what's happened in the meantime is during Act Two they've had a series of challenges, right? They've had a series So they had to navigate Mos Eisley to find a pilot to get them off of Tatooine. Ben and Luke did, and the droids. They get captured by the Death Star. They realize the princess is on board. They split up. Some of them have to go rescue the princess, and that involves shootouts and trash compactors. Obi-Wan, but they're trapped by the tractor beams. So Obi-Wan has to go off. There's a series of obstacles throughout Act Two, ending in apparent defeat or apparent imminent defeat. Then Act Three. Right, and Act Three is Act Three in a Hollywood film is usually one of the subplots. Okay, if it's artfully done, some previously relatively unnoticed or minor thread of the story now provides the insight which the hero uses to win. So Act Three in Star Wars is the assault on the Death Star, and of course Luke goes and fires his proton torpedoes and blows the Death Star up. And this is very important. This is very important. Does he use his targeting computer?
No. Well, he starts to.
He starts to, and then hears Obi-Wan's voice says, "Use the Force, Luke." Right? Because one of his subplots, he's had a kind of flirtation with the princess subplot, which gets a little bit creepy in hindsight. But his big subplot is that he's learning to use the Force. And so the answer to the big problem in Act Three turns out to be, don't use the targeting computer, take the impossible shot, put your faith in the Force, and the Force will let you do it. And so the subplot here gives the hero the insight he needs, Luke in this case, he needs to succeed at his big trial. So that is a Hollywood film. And a Hollywood film, again, almost always, the ones that don't stand out, you can usually, even if you don't consciously know format, you can usually feel it. So an example is the movie AI by Steven Spielberg, which really has four acts. And so at a certain point, it just suddenly feels too long. When the kid goes into the ice, it feels like that's three acts. It should be over now. And it's not because of the time that's passed. It's because of you've had three acts. And similarly, a Shakespearean play, for someone who is only accustomed to watching Hollywood movies, about two-thirds of the way through, suddenly feels like it's really long. And it's not the time. It's that Shakespeare wrote in five acts. So we intuitively feel this structure. So look, that by itself, knowing the three-act structure is useful to a writer, to an editor, again, because it's so ubiquitous in Hollywood filmmaking, very likely your readers, if you're writing for the English-speaking world at least, and whether they know it or not, they have been imbibing this structure the whole life. Now, that's an example of structure. That's just bonus content there. Now let's talk about the hero's journey. So the guy who first published this idea is Joseph Campbell. He became famous in the 80s. Bill Moyers, PBS guy, got fascinated in his work and did a series of videos. But Campbell really published the idea in 1949. With a book called The Hero with a Thousand Faces. And if you have read that, then maybe much of what I say may be redundant or obvious. And if you haven't, I would invite you to. Hero with a Thousand Faces. I don't think it's gone out of print since. It is a classic. I actually happen to have an edition with Luke Skywalker on the cover, as it happens. So, and Campbell was a student of mythology, and he was a student of Carl Jung, and I don't mean student literally. I don't know whether he studied with him, but he was an intellectual disciple. He was interested in the ideas of Carl Jung, and Jung thought that our unconscious mind organized itself into repeated common archetypes, images that are universal to humanity, and that these popped up in art, and that they popped up in dreams, and they pop up in storytelling. And Jung was a literal student of Freud, so for Jung this was about psychotherapy, right? So listening to what a person said in recounting their dreams or in making art would give you access to what was going on in their unconscious mind so you could heal them. That was Jung. So Campbell came up with this idea, which has been called sometimes the monomyth, right? Well, mono meaning the only myth, or usually the hero's journey. And Hero with a Thousand Faces is where he published it. And he is a popularizer. So if you try and read Jung, you're going to get this dense translated from German prose. If you read Campbell, you're reading somebody that, you know, is writing for a popular audience. And the idea is this. Really, there is only one story. Now, I'm not saying this is true. In fact, I would be thrilled to hear anybody disagree and fight back. The claim is that there's really only one story, and the stories resolve themselves into a set of very common elements, and that they are, and that this is a Jungian thing, that everyone has this idea of a story built into them. So why is this interesting? Well, to the extent that he's right, Campbell has given us another way to think about the organization of a story. Rather than saying, I'm going to write this in three acts or in five acts, you can say, I'm going to use the elements of a hero's journey to compose a story. Then as editors, we can say, look, I am reading a story, and I am the advocate for the reader. I love that phrase. So I'm not only going to help clarify language, but I'm thinking about this as a hero's journey, and knowing what the pieces of a hero's journey are, I can say, you know, there's a piece that you haven't put in here. And I can go to the author and say, you know, you might consider X, right? What about adding an initial refusal to go on the journey? What about adding a meeting with the goddess? And actually three, there's another interesting thing about this. The monomyth exists, or here's the claim, okay, not only universally in storytelling, but also in initiation ritual, meaning the same pattern that informs Star Wars, the only two Star Wars, and The Lord of the Rings, and The Odyssey, and whatever, also shapes how Aboriginal youth were taken out into the desert and circumcised and made to hear the roaring of the bull roarer off in the bushes and transformed from children into adults. Which if it's true, that should give the monomyth some really interesting resonance, some ability to create fiction that and to shape fiction into something that really connects with people on a deep, on even a spiritual level, right? To tell stories that are themselves a kind of initiation. That's why I think the hero's journey is exciting. So let's talk about the pieces. So first of all, any true hero's journey is circular. It ends in the same place it begins in at least some respect. Okay? So in fact, Hollywood films generally do this. Hollywood films generally, not always, will show you some defining image of the film right up front, maybe even behind the closing credits. Maybe it's we're panning into the city and it's dark, right? And it's night and we see the dirt and the filth, and we sense the danger. And then at the end, we'll get a version of that same image, and any change that has happened during the film will be reflected in the change from image one to image two. Maybe this is a dark story, and we We see the city again, and it's still filthy, and there are rats crawling over the garbage, right? And this is a cynical story. Nothing ever changes. Or maybe we see the city as we're panning back for the closing credits, and it's dawn, and it's the same city, but now the light has come, right? Or maybe it's still dark, but we see that lone heroine, and she's standing looking bold. She has overcome, even though nothing around her has changed, right? And those tell us different things about the theme. So a hero's journey, you'll see a diagram that's a circle. In fact, usually it's a circle with a top half and a bottom half. And this dates back to Campbell. Campbell himself did this. And the hero starts in the top half. And the hero ends in the top half. Okay? This is, hey, the Hobbit, right? The Hobbit is there and back again. There and back again is the subtitle, right? A Hobbit's Holiday. The Lord of the Rings. So Frodo starts in the Shire. He leaves. He's got to come back to the Shire. It's absolutely essential that Frodo come back to the Shire. In fact, there are people who criticize the last few chapters of the Lord of the Rings and say this is superfluous. Once Sauron is defeated, Aragorn gets married, and that should be the end. But they're wrong. They're wrong. It's absolutely essential that Frodo come back to the Shire, and we'll talk about why in a minute. The hero starts at home, right? The hero's journey, the hero starts in a village. And the village is sick. Maybe the hero doesn't realize it yet. There's something wrong with the village. There is an imminent danger, right? There are ringwraiths creeping about at night. The dark ring of power is insidiously corrupting the Shire from within and attracting evil to it. The countryside is filling up with orcs and wolves, and the village is threatened. There's a problem with the village. So we're going to see our hero then in the village, and once we see the hero in the village, and usually enough to realize how the village is sick, and in psychoanalysis, of course, the sickness of the village is a reflection of the sickness in the hero. You'll get a call to adventure. Something will happen to summon the hero down into the lower half of the circle. And the lower half of the circle is the world of adventure. It's the fairy world. It's the underworld. It is the wider world outside the Shire. What does that call to adventure look like? Well, if you're Harry Potter, it looks like a letter, or an owl that comes and throws a letter in the mail slot, right? If you are Bilbo Baggins, it is the wizard who shows up to your door, and in Gandalf's first appearance. So some kind of something happens, maybe literally a messenger, maybe an event. If you're Luke Skywalker, it is R2-D2, right? Who Luke buys the droids and is tinkering around with R2 with some kind of screwdriver. And R2, this is, of course, deliberate, right? Not because Luke unplugs a bolt or whatever. R2 plays his film of Princess Leia. Help us, Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're our only hope. That's the call to adventure. Now, sometimes you have stories where that's enough. The hero hears the call to adventure, the heroine hears the call to adventure, and she eagerly rushes forward. Very, very commonly, you have instead a hero who chooses at first not to take the adventure. So that's Luke, right? Luke says, Obi-Wan Kenobi, I guess that could be old Ben, follows the droids out, meets Ben Kenobi, and then refuses to go with him, despite the fact that he in his own heart would like to leave Tatooine, but he won't do it, because he's got the farm, and got to get the harvest in, and he's dutiful. Bilbo refuses dealings with Gandalf initially, and shuts the door and wishes him good day, right? Prompting Gandalf to write the secret rune for burglar on his door. So Harry Potter doesn't refuse his journey, the Dursleys refuse it for him. So very commonly you have a hero who is reluctant, and her first reaction is that she does not want to go on the adventure. In which case there are repeated invitations, right? And maybe even the hero's hand is forced. So if you're Harry Potter, more and more letters get hurled through the mail slot until the massive owls on Privet Lane, you know, force the Dursleys to surrender, and you go to Hogwarts. Or you're Luke and the stormtroopers come and kill Aunt Beru and Uncle Owen. Or you're Bilbo and the dwarf show up. And they think they've been, Gandalf has invited them. They come in and they won't go. So at some point the hero accepts and goes to go on a journey. So now if you're an editor, right, these are elements you can look for. Now your protagonist, your writer may not be deliberately following the hero's, the hero's journey as a model in her writing, whether she is or not, and you might suggest it consciously to her, hey, look at the, have you considered looking, what you're writing has a lot of resonance with the hero's journey, here's something you could look at. You could still suggest components, right? So in the first part of a novel, you might say, oh, what are some things you're looking for? Well, you know, I want to get a sense of where the hero is from. What is the village? I want to get a sense of in what way the village is sick or what the problems are, right? And this is not very different. It's a different way to talk about some similar ideas to the Hollywood structure, because you're saying, hey, what is the hero's desire? What is the hero's need? What is it the hero doesn't have? And look, I'm looking for some clear something that forces the hero's hand and makes her choose to take action and enter into the world of adventure, right? You could call that the end, my end of act one, my precipitating event, or whatever term Hollywood uses. And actually, if you're interested in that, there's a book called Save the Cat, and I forget the name of the author. I can go pull it off my shelf in the next room. That's a good one, a good, easy, accessible one for kind of screenwriting and Hollywood structure. But in either of those paradigms give you a tool to say to the writer, okay, I think maybe something could be added here earlier on. All right, so the hero chooses to go on the adventure. The hero crosses a threshold. There may be guardians. There may be things blocking your way into the land of the dead, right? Into the land of adventure, into the fairy world. So those may be something like the Tom Bombadil and the malevolent trees, right? Old Man Willow. In the forest, the Brandywine Woods, or the forest on the Brandywine River, right, are an example. Or that could be in Mos Eisley, the guy with the walrus head, and his kind of pug-nosed friend who try and pick a fight, right? Wretched hive of scum and villainy are the guardians of the threshold, and we have to get through those first, some kind of initial trials. Very often, not always, very often your hero is going to have a mentor. Some kind of helper. And by the way, right, the minute we see Albus Dumbledore and realize he's an ally to Harry, he's going to help. The minute we see Obi-Wan Kenobi, not so much in the desert, well, even then when he's killing the Sandman, but when we see him in Mos Eisley, you know, slicing off the arm of the guy that tries to kill Luke and protecting Luke. We know those guys are going to die, right? We know Obi-Wan and we know Dumbledore are going to die, or they're going to, from the story point of view, they're going to die. They have to get out of the way somehow, right? Why? Why do we know Obi-Wan Kenobi can't survive?
The hero has to step up and finish his own adventure.
Yeah, and it's the same thing with Qui-Gon Jinn before him, right? In the mostly lamentable episode one, the hero.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, there is no episode one. So the hero has to have the adventure, right? The hero has to have the adventure. There's a similar issue anytime you write children's fiction. You got to figure out how to make the adults not just save the day, right? And this is why you have so many stories about orphans or parents who are away or absent or too busy or something. The hero has to have her own adventure. So a mentor figure, what's a mentor going to do? It may help you through the threshold. It may help you in your initial challenges. But the mentor is going to have to get out of the way sometime before the climax, right? Now, maybe the mentor is imprisoned, doesn't have to die necessarily, but from the point of view of the story, the mentor has to die. The mentor has to disappear. Otherwise, there's no story. So the hero has entered the world of adventure, and that may be literally a new world, right? Literally the underworld or the fairy world. It may be, as in The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, passing out of my safe little Hobbiton into the wider world, and which is different, right? It's not all hobbits anymore, and the mayor at Mickledelving, and like suddenly we have wolves and these dangerous ranger people and orcs and even dragons. And even early on, right, Sam Gamgee and Ted Sandyman are sitting around the Green Dragon talking about the walking trees and the stuff you see outside the borders of the Shire. Or it may be that actually physically nothing has changed, but in the physical place where I am, things have become dangerous and they become scary. The Fisher King with Robin Williams, with Jeff Bridges, this is from like in the kind of the late 80s or early 90s, it's an older film now, Terry Gilliam is very, very consciously following Joseph Campbell and his hero's journey. And so even though the hero hasn't moved anywhere, the world becomes a sort of surreal and terrifying place as he goes through his series of journeys. So the next thing that happens is a series of trials, And in, you know, this can be Odysseus, dealing with the witch Circe, dealing with the Cyclops, dealing with the Lotus Eaters, ultimately becoming imprisoned slash enamored of Calypso. So a series of challenges and temptations. The hero is progressively tried. From a pacing point of view, these should get harder and harder, and the hero is learning things. And ultimately, something the hero learns in here is going to let the hero not only succeed on this journey, but be successful when she returns home. This is, you know, in Sumerian mythology, it's Inanna descending into hell, or it's Gilgamesh when his friend Enkidu has died. He goes on a series of, he goes on a journey, and he's looking for Utnapishtim, the one group of people that survived the flood were Utnapishtim and his family, and he has to, Gilgamesh goes through a series of trials that involve, you know, crawling through a mountain and an encounter with Siduri, the divine barmaid. So Campbell talks about then the sort of climax of this journey he calls it the meeting with the goddess or the sacred marriage, okay? So the hero... it doesn't have to really be a marriage, but there is a climactic moment. There is the greatest conflict, and the hero succeeds at doing the hardest thing. Now there are should be two results or one result, maybe with a nuance. Of this conflict. So first of all, the hero should be himself transformed out of this encounter. So the hero has learned things along the way. The hero is a dramatically different person. And a great example of this, well, and here's the other point. The hero comes away wounded. The hero comes away wounded. A hero who survives his journey without a wound is not a true hero. And so an example, a great example of this is Frodo from Lord of the Rings. And I risk going on a very long digression here because I'm such a Tolkien fan. But there's also a connection with Tolkien's, with the implicit throughout Christianity of what Tolkien is writing here, okay? So Frodo has gone on his journey, right? Frodo is called by Gandalf. He leaves the Shire and you know, a series of trials, right? There are the Ringwraiths on Weathertop. There's Moria. There's the death of Boromir, the seductive kind of peril of the elves in Lothlorien, you know, the breaking up of the fellowship, Smeagol crossing the marshes of the Emmenuel, right? All that great stuff. On Frodo's journey, and sort of the marriage with the goddess really for Frodo happens on Mount Doom. And Frodo has been changing all the while. Okay, and I'm going to get slightly off topic because I'm such a fan of this and I think it's really underappreciated. Who is it that ultimately destroys the ring? It isn't Frodo. Frodo gets to the end, right, and he fails, and somebody else destroys the ring. Who destroys the Ring of Power?
Gollum.
Yeah. It is, in fact, actually Gollum. It is Gollum. And...
Crazy.
Sam has observed that Frodo has looked more and more like Gollum all along the way. And Gandalf tells him, you know, the Ring of Power leaves its mark upon its bearers, right? That's the explanation. But there's another explanation, because so here's the explicit Christianity piece. Tolkien's on record writing to a Jesuit friend of his. He says, I fear I've written a book that is far too Christian and, in fact, far too Catholic for most people. And a lot of commentators just totally miss this and say that what you've got is a pagan Germanic legend. But here's the key thing, right? So Gollum, or Sam, when Sam wakes up, he's in the Houses of Healing in Gondor, and the Gandalf says to him, "Forever after will the people of Gondor remember and honor March 25th as the day Sauron fell." Now March 25th, that makes it the day. March 25th is the day that Gollum grabs the ring and throws himself into Mount Doom and is destroyed. Well, it turns out that March 25th, in the medieval English liturgical, Catholic liturgical calendar, March 25th was the day they believed the crucifixion happened, which means the day that Gollum takes the ring, the great sin of the world, and throws himself into his destruction on Mount Doom / Golgotha, is the day that Christ is crucified. So that Gollum is the most powerful but least obvious Christ figure in the Lord of the Rings. He's the man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. There is no beauty in him that we should desire him. And Frodo, in walking his road, has come to look more and more and more like Gollum as the Christian disciple looks more and more like Christ. All right, sorry. That's an
aside. My gosh. That just blew my mind.
Lord of the Rings is amazing. All right, so I had to say that. But the point from the hero's journey, right? And by the way, Campbell talked about the Gospels and their account of Christ's life in terms of the hero's journey, right? So it's not too far off. From the hero's journey point of view, Frodo gets there. He has his supreme trial. Think about it from the Hollywood, the subplot point of view. He is saved by mercy, not because Gollum chooses to give mercy to him, right? Gollum does not, but his mercy in sparing Gollum's life, his pity, is the thing that in the end saves him. Blessed are the merciful, they shall have mercy shown unto them, right? And when he cannot carry the burden, Gollum takes it, throws himself in the pit and dies. But Frodo comes out wounded. So Frodo has been transformed. He is, in a sense, no longer a creature of this world. He's different. He's wiser. He is also wearier. And he's literally wounded because Gollum bites off a finger. So there's the supreme climactic trial. The hero succeeds. Moment of great insight. The hero is transformed. There is a price paid. The death of Obi-Wan Kenobi, right? The price paid, which is an atonement for an original sin, Frodo loses a finger and Gollum dies as an atonement for the ring. Obi-Wan dies as an atonement maybe for his errors with his young Padawan Anakin, which I have heard rumors of, but there is no movie describing that ever happening, so I don't know. And then the hero has to go back. So here's what I was saying earlier. Some people say about Lord of the Rings, it should end in Gondor. And they're wrong. They're totally wrong. It's essential that the hero go home because the village was sick. We didn't see it at first with the Shire. We didn't see it. We knew there was something wrong with Bilbo. He kind of lived too long. He never seemed to age. He felt like butter scraped over too much bread, right? There's something wrong with that. We didn't know quite what it was. Frodo started to feel the same way. You hear about strange happenings outside the Shire. Well, now the sickness is full-blown, and it's Saruman. And Tolkien's, it's not politics exactly, but partly you see here a manifestation of Tolkien's love of his sort of, I don't mean this in a political sense, but his conservatism, right? His love of the countryside, his mixed feelings about the Industrial Revolution, because the sickness, when it's full-blown for Tolkien, takes the form of a kind of industrialization of the Shire in the ugliest possible way. In the ugliest possible way. And Peter Jackson got this really right by showing Isengard to be extremely like a factory. It's a big factory. It's all industrial. And this is what Saruman brings to the Shire. It is important that Frodo and the Hobbits come home because the village was sick to begin with, and the hero, having gone into the other world, now comes back with insight, with magic powers gained from the goddess, the meeting with the goddess, the climactic encounter, the Force. Luke learns to use the Force. Harry Potter has begun to master his magical powers. He's begun to have some ability with them, right? Bilbo, when he comes back, like Frodo, they have a very similar kind of pattern. They leave as sort of country squires, and they come back as adventurers, as warriors. And so Bilbo comes in and puts a stop to the auction of his stuff, right? Frodo, Merry, Pippin, and Sam come back and drive Saruman and Sharky, right, he's now called, and all of his minions out of the Shire. It's essential. You see the same sequence in the Odyssey. It is essential that Odysseus come home where there is a sickness at home because it's a sickness, it's a violation of Xenia, the guest-host relationship. There are suitors hanging around in Odysseus' home courting his wife. It's outrageous behavior on the part of guests. And Odysseus will come home and assist Telemachus in putting that to right. So that's how the hero's journey ends. In the same place it begins, but the hero's different. The hero's no longer villager in a sick village, sick herself, maybe doesn't see it. The hero comes back, and she now has the power to heal everybody. She has the power to put things right in the world. All right. So I actually intended to talk a lot less and have a lot more conversation. So what I probably ought to do now is shut up and say and ask, hey, are there any comments you want to make or objections or questions or points?
I had a little question on the coming home and finding the city sick or the home, there's a sickness there.
Yep.
How resolved does that sickness need to be at the end of the story? If it's
also
a standalone.
Interesting. Sorry, go ahead.
If it's a standalone story, if it's, you know, one book or the end of a trilogy, how cleaned up do you want to go with that sickness?
Yeah. So if it is a standalone story, you know, you decide whether you want a happy ending or a bittersweet ending, and you do it. If it's a series, I think the answer is you have to have enough that it feels like the hero has gone on a meaningful journey, right? The hero took a risk, almost died, or from the mythological point of view, did die, got insight, came back, remade, right? So, in fact, in shamanic initiation ritual, shamans enter sort of a dream state or a leaving their body state, and they are killed. They, in their dream, in their sacred shamanic initiation experience, they are killed by ogres, by cannibal ancestors, by dark spirits. They are usually torn to pieces. A great book on this is Mircea Eliade's Shamanism. It's the classical text on shamanic religion. They're torn to pieces, and then they are rebuilt. And they're rebuilt with iron bones or with quartz inserted in the place of their organs, right? So they're made new and better. And when they come out of their experience, they then have their shamanic powers. They have their ability to communicate with spirits, to leave their body at will and enter the, you know, the heavens, the starry sky, the underworld, and heal. So this is sort of a, well, so two-part answer. One, it's got to feel satisfying, and there's an element of, I think, squint past your thumb there, right? Does it feel like they risked enough, lost enough, paid enough, and they got enough for it? And here's another observation. If you're working on a series, I'm not sure this is always true, but it's powerful when it can be true. Samuel Delaney, who wrote some pretty out there stuff, and he's sort of more literary as a fantasy novelist. He and I forget what the context of this observation was, but he said the solution in book one is the problem in book two. Now, I always say that's not always true, right? The Lord of the Rings was really written as one book, so it's not the case that you get to the end of the Fellowship of the Ring and some kind of solution creates the problem in book two. But I think it's neat when you can do that. In other words, the hero comes back and has a fix and repairs the village, but hints that actually that's not final, and that maybe even the nature of the repair creates a problem that will itself have to be resolved in the future. I think when you can do that, that's fantastic.
Thank you. That's eye-opening.
Yeah, I like that insight. Good. They basically summed up in one sentence, how to write a sequel. That's really cool.
Yeah, when you can do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, other comments, objections?
Who is the name of the lady that wrote the book on shamanism?
It's he's a Romanian guy. His last name is Eliade, spelled Eliade, and he's a huge name in kind of mid-20th century comparative religion. So honestly, I think I have like 12 books by him, and they're all fantastic. His most famous is not the one on shamanism. It's called The Sacred and the Profane. And that's just – school kids should read that book. It's a crime that they don't. But the shamanism book is called Shamanism, Archaic Techniques of Ecstasy, I think. Eliade, Eliade.
Okay.
I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. He's Romanian, I think.
Well, we should probably wrap up, but if anyone has any last questions for Dave, please speak up.
Yeah, and please feel free. Look, I'm pretty active on Facebook. There's a lot of people named Dave Butler, but I'm dave.butler.16. Or you can email me, david.john@hotmail.com. I'd be happy to chat and give you book titles. By the way, I'm pretty sure there's a Wikipedia article. I think if you type in, it might be Hero's Journey, or it might be Monomyth. You can find a pretty good kind of discussion if you don't have the time or will to go read a whole book.
Awesome. Well, great. That was wonderful, Dave. I know I learned so much, and I have a lot buzzing through my head for my own writing and essays. So we're very glad that we could have you.
You're very kind. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, all right. If no one else has anything to add, and sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, Dave. Like, do you feel you've messed up in the way that you intended?
No, only that I talk too much, and I should have asked more questions. But thank you all very much. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you, Caroline, for setting this up.
Yeah,
thank you.
That's
great.
If anyone has any questions about AudioSPPA, you can send an email to audiosppainfo@gmail.com. And we'd love to have you all join us again for a roundtable next month, if you like. We'll be putting out information about that in the next few weeks. So. Yeah, well, thank you, everyone, for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.